Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm Cindy Howes, and I host this podcast. Before we get into Ethan Sitiawan, let's talk about ways that we can stay in touch. Okay, the best way to do it is to sign up for the Basic Folk monthly newsletter. You can do that at our website, basicfolk.com. Click on the red button. There's also a link in the show notes. There's a link in the show notes to follow us on social media. We're active on Facebook and Instagram at Basic Folk Pod. We're also a listener-supported podcast, and you can make a contribution at our website. There's also a link in the show notes to do that. You can go to the shop and get a Basic Folk beanie that are hand-knit by my mom. That's at basicfolk.com. Okay, let's get into it. Is mandolinist Ethan Sitiawan 100 years old? The Indiana-born Sitiawan's expert playing will fool you into thinking he's four times his actual age. Thanks to a supportive family and Mennonite community, Ethan came to the mandolin and folk music at an early age. His impressive proficiency and technical prowess landed him a full scholarship to Berklee College of Music in Boston. There, he was exposed to all different types of music and developed that natural rhythm and groove that only comes with being in musical community. His new instrumental album, Gambit, was produced by his mentor, the legendary fiddler Daryl Anger, best known for being in the original lineup for the David Grisman Quintet. Through Daryl, Ethan was able to work on a tradition of his own through music built from a foundation of bluegrass. He talks about that, and he explains what the bluegrass vocabulary is on the mandolin for dum-dums like me who do not play music and are not folk scholars. Sitiawan is an in-demand sideman and band member and can be seen playing with his band Corner House, Daryl Anger, and Tony Trischka, among others. Enjoy Ethan and get to know his new record, Gambit. We'll take a listen to this song from his new record. This is Back Dog, and then we'll get to Ethan Sitiawan on Basic Folk. Ethan Sitiawan, thank you so much for joining us today on Basic Folk.
Of course. Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
So I found a couple of lines about how old you are. Bluegrass Situation, had a great article on you and said the Berklee College of Music grad could easily fool you into thinking he's much older than his years. And in your bio of your performance of the mandolin, it says Satyawan has a command of the instrument far beyond his 25 years. I feel like I've asked a few guests about how they feel about their age recently. So hopefully, like, if listeners are like, here she goes again. But do you feel older? Are you 25 now?
I am still 25, yeah.
Okay. Do you feel older than 25? Like, how do you relate to your age, and what has that relationship looked like throughout your life?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I've always kind of been interacting with many different age groups, which I think is a really valuable thing to do, to not just be kind of inside your own sort of peer group as far as age for your social circle, age is a funny one for our society, I think. We really place a lot of importance on it. I've never really worried about it too much, I guess. I've always been, interested in hanging out with people from all kinds of different ages and situations there. But, you know, people say, you know, I'm mature or whatever. They say things like that. So, yeah, it's kind of been.
They call you an old soul.
Some things like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How annoying.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah. You are originally from Goshen, Indiana, and were raised Mennonite, just like your friend and mine, Sadie Gustafson-Zook.
Yes.
I found you on the Facebook group Mennofolk, which is
a
wonderful intersection of Mennonites and folk arts. How did your hometown and specifically your religion influence the type of musician you are?
Totally, yeah. The Mennonite church has a really amazingly beautiful singing tradition. There's a lot of emphasis on four-part harmony, choral harmony, and going to church on any given Sunday, any given church pretty much, you get a lot of really amazing singers singing in really beautiful harmony. So I think that has kind of always been in my ear, you know, sort of choral harmony, which if you go back, you know, it takes you to Bach and music that I really love, that's written for instruments other than the voice. But yeah, there's a lot of really deep musical tradition just right there in front of you in the Mennonite church. But I came up in sort of this really, as you know, hippie, liberal Mennonite community, which was really open to music other than that sort of traditional choral thing, which was really fun for me to kind of be able to participate in that way from an early age, playing the mandolin. And definitely I was part of some really supportive church communities in Goshen, which is a huge important piece for any musician, just having that community there that's willing to listen and help you out with, you know, whatever your musical journey takes you to.
From what you can tell, is it still the same in Goshen, or how has it changed?
I think it's similar. I haven't been super active in that community in the past however long, 4 or 5 years.
Just seems like an important one since it's produced two of our faves.
Sure. Yeah.
Sadie and yourself.
Totally. Yeah. I do love going back to Goshen and kind of seeing people in the area. I guess I just haven't been to a church in the last little while, but definitely going to Goshen and going anywhere, I'll run into people from those communities. And it's really always really nice to see those folks. I mean, some of my earliest musical memories on the mandolin had to do with the church and hanging out in those spaces. Mm-hmm. So there's some really important people to me who are in those communities that I get to see every once in a while when I'm back in town.
You were one of three children who were homeschooled by folk-loving parents, and I'd love to hear more about that. Can you set the scene for what music looked like in your house?
Yeah, totally. So my mom plays piano, took piano lessons and likes to play, hymns and such and tunes. So that was kind of always there. So yeah, as far as the folk music, they love stuff like Simon and Garfunkel, Peter, Paul, and Mary, that kind of folk artist. So we always had those tapes in the car, CDs and such. And yeah, you know, they also had this tape by a group that was called Harder to Do. So a bunch of their friends that worked up at this Mennonite camp in Michigan, my parents and the musicians in this band were all there at the same time. So that tape was in the car a lot. And
oh, it was a band of their friends.
Yeah, not them. My parents weren't in this band, but their friends at this camp. You know, they would do music at the camp and play some gigs here and there. But there's mandolin on that tape, and I think that would be my first memory of hearing the mandolin and kind of asking, "What is that instrument?" And they're like, "Well, I think it's the mandolin," you know.
yeah.
So yeah, that's where it goes back to.
When do you remember? I mean that. Memory that you just shared was lovely, but like, when do you remember first connecting with music, as in like music that you liked independently from your family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so the first instrument I played was cello, and my folks kind of said to me and my siblings, when you're 8 or 9, you'll take lessons on an instrument and you can choose. Like there was, you know, some choice in the matter, but they were like, we'd like you to learn to play an instrument, which everybody was interested in and down to do. And so I chose the cello. And yeah, I'm trying to think kind of when it first clicked, because for a while it was sort of just going to lessons and practicing and it was okay. But I think probably when I started to enjoy it was when I started playing with groups. You know, there were these string ensembles of a bunch of students at the community music school in Goshen. So we would get together and they would, you know, teach us tunes and we'd play different parts. And then I was in like a youth orchestra and a string quartet, and that was really fun. And then, yeah, when I started kind of actually the music that started to really grab me was the Bach cello suites. That really, you know, that was maybe the first piece of music that I learned.
It was Bach. It wasn't Black Sabbath.
No.
Or Blink 182.
No.
Not Black Sabbath, not Blink 182. Bach.
Yeah. Bach.
Okay.
The minuets from the first cello suite are in one of the Suzuki cello books, and I learned those, and I remember, yeah, that was really a beautiful, they are beautiful pieces of music, and it felt like real music, if you know what I mean. Everything else, other music that I played alone on the cello, I mean, it's music, and there's beautiful ways to play it, but the thing with Bach is that it's just, if you're playing some of the solo cello or violin suites, you have these complete pieces of music. There's nothing else required beyond you playing this this instrument. And that was really cool.
And how old were you when you were like, Bach, this is it?
Yeah, probably like 13, 14. And that was around the time that I started playing the mandolin as well.
And how were you listening to Bach? Were you playing it, or did you listen to it on CDs or anything?
Yeah, both. The thing with the Suzuki method, just in brief, is sort of that you listen to things on repeat and you get them in your ear, and then the idea is to be able to play them by ear pretty quickly.
Okay.
And so there's definitely a lot of listening to these pieces, but it's really satisfying to play, and I still find that Bach is a really satisfying music to play just because it's so complete. So playing it on the cello was a really cool moment.
What was like your, you know, in learning to play the cello and learning to play the mandolin as a young person, especially at your age, like how did the internet play into that learning, into your learning style?
Yeah, I don't feel like it played into it all that much, actually. My folks were...
Did you have access to it? Were your parents letting you log on to AOL?
Not quite so much, actually. We lived a pretty tech-free life for a lot of my childhood until I was about...
Oh, so you're like an exennial. You're like an elder millennial.
I am, yeah. And that's kind of going back to the age thing. I would hang out with Sadie, you know, and kind of, she's, I guess, 2 years older than me. So I'd hang out with Sadie and sort of her friends at Goshen College, the college in town there. And so I was always sort of around people older than me for a lot of the time. So yeah, it's as far as the whole generation thing goes, it's kind of a funny place that I've landed. But yeah, I mean, I think I really value kind of an upbringing that was light on tech And I definitely use it a lot now, and it's a great tool, of course. Mm-hmm.
Do you design your own websites?
I have in the past, but I have passed it off recently.
Okay. Yeah. All right, because like your website and Corner House's website have the same kind of like really nice aesthetic.
Right. Well, that would be Louise Bicken, who is in Corner House, and yeah, she did
Louise's
mine as well.
Louise's aesthetic.
Exactly. Yeah, I trust her far more than I trust my aesthetic. So, yeah, that's a mutually beneficial. Good for
All
me.
All right.
At
least. Thank you for the deep dive into your tech and website talk.
Yeah, of course.
Back to the other stuff. Okay. Community and collaboration are a through line in your story. So you grew up in a supportive community and have found that community through music. When did you realize its importance, and how has community changed for you over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I count myself lucky to kind of be part of a bunch of different communities. Of course, we've been talking about the hometown crowd in Indiana, which is a really beautiful scene. But there's also this really extensive bluegrassy acoustic folk community that is really beautiful, just in that it's really spread out all across the states and across the world. It's spread out, but it's small, you know, it really feels small and pretty tight. So if you know people in Maine, there's definitely somebody that you also know in Alaska that you'll get connected with if needs be, or if you want to be, you know. Yeah, that scene is really, really special, and I count myself lucky to be a part of it.
So going back to finding your instrument, you did talk about how you tried out several instruments before you got to the mandolin. You played cello, banjo, ukulele. How did you know that these other instruments weren't for you and that you should keep looking, as opposed to like, nose to the grindstone, I'm just going to work through this banjo thing?
Yeah, totally. So I guess the first, I had a couple little flirtations with different instruments. I guess first would have been the mountain dulcimer, which, you know,
all right.
That left out. Yeah, kind of funny. But yeah, you know, I was interested in this, in sort of playing fiddle tunes, folk music, and I don't even really remember how the mountain dulcimer came to be, but somehow, you know, we got a cardboard one. They make these mountain dulcimers out of cardboard with
strings.
Yeah. So the fretboard is wood. There's this like wooden stick on top of it with tuners and frets and whatever. But then like the resonating box, the body is cardboard. So wow. I had one of those.
Is it from IKEA?
It could be. Yeah. It kind of looks like that. no, I got it from this little music store in Shipshewana, the Amish town in Indiana, Northern Indiana.
Oh, of course. Shipshewana.
Yeah, exactly. You must know it.
Yes. Lovely.
Yes. So yeah, mountain dulcimer, and I was playing these fiddle tunes, but the mountain dulcimer is not a chromatic instrument. It's a diatonic instrument, so it's pretty limited in terms of what keys it plays.
What is that? What does diatonic mean?
Diatonic is in a key. So basically you can play in D or G on a mountain dulcimer.
Okay.
And chromatic.
So it's limited.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like what you just said. I'm sorry, I'll just listen now.
No, it's okay. It's good, good to clarify that stuff. With a chromatic instrument like a mandolin or a guitar or a banjo, you have all the notes, you know, you can play in any key. And for folk music, it makes a lot of sense to have a diatonic instrument that only plays in certain keys, because that's often most of what you might want to do. But I was interested in playing fiddle tunes that went beyond D and G, basically. And so I had this other thing with the ukulele. I was part of this homeschool community that basically met 2 days a week and kind of had a quasi-school for a bunch of the kids in these families. And one of the dads in that group started a ukulele choir. So that was a chromatic instrument. So that was cool for me to kind of be able to play songs in many different keys, but it's not really a melody instrument per se. So I was kind of looking for this melody. So I'm kind of, you know, wending my way through a bunch of options to the mandolin eventually, which is tuned in fifths like the cello. So that was a really easy transition. and it's used in fiddle music, and I wanted to play something with a pick for some reason. And
I hear you love picks.
I do love picks, the bluegrass situation. I really kind of had a field day with that. That was good.
So when you came to the mandolin, you loved it, and it sounds like you really liked how small it was. You said it was small but packed a bigger punch than the ukulele. How do you still relate to that punch the mandolin provides and the initial feeling you had when you first connected to the instrument?
Yeah, totally. I think I was talking about punch in sort of a vague sense with that statement, just in that the ukulele felt more limited. But the mandolin has a lot of sort of rhythmic capability that I really enjoy working with now. Mm-hmm. So that's cool. That's kind of a literal punch, I guess, in some ways. and I was interested in this folk music back then. That was kind of the initial thing. But I've really been playing many different kinds of music, or at least music from many different parts of the world recently. And something like the banjo is really limited, it feels to me, tonally, right? It kind of sounds a certain way and it's expected to play certain kinds of music for the most part. And the mandolin it definitely fits into bluegrass and old time, and that's kind of where I started from. But simply the quality of the sound is not quite as specific as some other instruments.
How does it feel to express yourself through the mandolin? Like, the mandolin does seem like a pretty powerful instrument. And I don't know you, but you seem like a very, like, even-keeled, dry sense of humor type of person just from talking to you for a half an hour. But, like, how do you feel like the mandolin is an extension of your personality, or it allows you to, like, express different sides of your personality?
Yeah, totally. Well, I like, it's an interesting thing, like expression in any kind of music. And kind of what it's been for me is to, like, work on really specific things in practice. And then on the gig, it's sort of, who knows what could happen. At that point, it's we're out there playing and trying stuff. So, yeah, working on really specific rhythms. I've been really into this South American music, a lot of different styles down there. Choro is a big mandolin style that comes from Brazil. A lot of really beautiful melodies and rhythms there. And then I've been playing quite a bit of Venezuelan music recently, and some Argentinian music and Peruvian music. And just kind of taking some of those ideas and the way that they feel eighth notes, which is so different to North American music, and just trying to integrate that a little bit into how I play rhythm, play backup for, I'm here in Vermont on tour with Louise Bick, and we're just playing duo. And so I'm always trying to think about how to back up a fiddle player, you know, and doing that in different ways and just trying to really get inside that a little bit. I guess drawing from a lot of different wells and trying to really dig deep into things in my personal practice, and then getting to the gig, which maybe people kind of think that, like, that's where you really express yourself. And that's probably true to some degree. But also, anytime you play music, you're expressing yourself artistically as well. But I guess the gig or the recording session is where it becomes public. Just really trying to let the ears be open all the time and follow threads where they might lead.
You entered Berklee a very technically oriented musician, but after being around many different styles and musicians, your horizons were broadened. And that's great. That's what college is supposed to do.
Totally.
So can you talk about what it was like for you to evolve from a precise and technical player into what you became?
Yeah, totally. I do think that good technique and facile technique is the underpinning of, you know, being expressive, right? You have to be able to play what you hear in order to make it, have people hear it. So I definitely do value my time spent working on technique, and I do still work on it. But going to Berklee and just being around all those musicians, students and faculty alike, who all have such diverse tastes and listen to such different music was really valuable. I mean, Joe K. Walsh, the mandolinist, I took a lot of lessons from him at Berkeley, and he was always really good about saying, about, you know, listening to what I liked and working on stuff with me that I was interested in, but also saying, you know, check out so-and-so, check out the Bill Frisell and Fred Hirsch do a record, or the, you know, Jim Hall and Bill Evans do a record, which was a very different take on jazz and music than I had really kind of been interested in up to that point. And then, yeah, I mean, I was talking about the South American music just a little bit ago, and I'm in a band with Maurizio Fiore Salas and Noah Harrington called the Acoustic Nomads. And Maurizio's from Venezuela and is really into all of that South American music. So
how long has this band been together?
Let's see. I think we first made a recording and started playing shows in 2019.
Oh, okay.
So we've been around for a little bit, and we've been doing some stuff this year. It's been picking up a little bit, which is, it's really fun to play with those folks. Great challenge for me, going back to sort of that, you know, working on some of that music and trying to get inside of that. But, you know, I would definitely not have gotten as far into that music without those two people, you know. And then playing with Louise has really, and Casey Murray in Corner House has really gotten me interested in sort of Celtic, Scottish, Irish, Swedish, Norwegian, all that kind of fiddle music from those countries. And yeah, you know, it's funny to think, I actually did sort of consider going to Goshen College, depending on how things would have worked out with Berkeley if the situation had been a little different. And it's so interesting to think what kind of a musician and person, you know, you would be if you had made a different choice like that.
Right. Open door two instead of door one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Was it touch and go with Berkeley, or did you get in, you know, smooth sailing for your admissions?
No, it was pretty painless. I ended up auditioning twice, and financially they made it work for me. So I ended up at Berkeley. Yeah.
That's great. In hearing that you came to college very technical, it makes me wonder, what has been your relationship to messing up and making mistakes?
Yeah, totally. I think that I was probably a lot more, I kind of go back and forth actually, but I think that overall I've become less worried about making mistakes, so to speak. I think that my bar for mistake is pretty low.
Me too.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, if on a recording session, recordings are interesting because you're sort of creating something that'll last for forever. So I do get a little more neurotic about that kind of thing. But if something doesn't go to plan, but it still works, I don't worry about that really at all anymore. If the moment feels good, I'm in pretty much. I did this camp in Savannah for a couple of years, Savannah, Georgia, called the Acoustic Music Seminar. And I got to work, I was lucky to work with Julian Lage quite a bit there, the great guitar player.
Cool guy, Julian Lage.
Yeah, exactly. That's him. And I think that was a big thing that I kind of took from him, is that, like, as long as people's ears are open and everyone's listening in the moment, it's hard to make a mistake per se. And of course, being on one side of the creative process as opposed to the, you know, being on the creation side of the creative process as opposed to the listening side, the end product side, is a very different experience, of course. So, yeah. Yeah.
The new album, Gambit, was produced by legendary fiddle player Daryl Anger. Some of his CV includes that he was a founding member of the David Grisman Quintet. He co-founded a couple bands like Psychograss, Mr. Sun, and he also plays on the Car Talk theme song. Did you know that?
I did know that, yes.
Yeah, everybody knows that. He seems like a huge influence in your musical life, and you met him when you were in high school. What influence had he had on you previously, and like, what was that first meeting like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I first met Daryl, it wasn't super it wasn't super deep. I think it must have been at one of the fiddle camps around the country, maybe the Swannanoa Gathering. But I've always loved his playing, of course. But I don't think we really connected until I was in college. You know, he taught at Berkeley for several years. And so when I was in school, we went and got a piece of pizza after an ensemble, and he hired me for a couple of holiday gigs.
Here's that pizza again.
At the pizza,
changing lives.
I do love pizza. So yeah, me and Daryl are eating pizza, and then we go and play these holiday gigs. And the next year, I took a bunch of lessons from Daryl and took an ensemble. So really got to work with him quite a bit that next year and played a gig that was really fun. Putting together him and his late partner Emmy Phelps put together a beautiful record of covers from the 60s and 70s called Music of Our People. That's a great record. And yeah, Daryl has a great knack for sort of arranging things and making music really fun. And I think one of the other things that stood out to me about those gigs is that I personally really felt, and I think that other people have had similar experiences, is that playing with Daryl kind of makes me feel the most like myself when I'm in that situation with him, which obviously felt like a great choice for a producer.
Sure, yeah,
go with somebody who really kind of draws a lot out of a person, and he was interested to do it, and we made a record, and yeah, it was a really great experience.
Here's a question. Do you have a mandolin nearby? Because I think you might need it to answer this question.
I do. Yeah, it's right over here.
Okay. So first, let me ask the question and then see if you need it.
Mm.
Okay. Because also, I just want to let you know, I'm not a musician, and I feel like the people that listen to Basic Folk are not musicians, so that's why we might need an audio answer. But
sure.
Okay. So on Bluegrass and How It Remains the Foundation of Your Music, you told BGS that bluegrass vocabulary on the mandolin is really the basis of most of my writing and my playing, and I think that comes through on the record almost more in the way that we approach the tunes and treat how we play the tunes more than the compositions themselves. I gotta tell you, I looked at that sentence for like 10 minutes, and I'm like, what does this mean? So if you could just break that down a little bit more, can you, in layman's terms, explain what the bluegrass vocabulary is on the mandolin, and how do you see bluegrass in your approach and treatment of the tunes?
Yeah, totally.
And this is where we might need the instrument.
Sure, I'll get the mandolin real quick. Let me grab that.
Okay. What kind of pick you got there, Ethan?
This is actually
all of the Ethan Satiawan stands are, do you think that they're excited about this, or are they rolling their eyes because they're like, here we go again.
Here we go. Yeah, he's about to.
A bluegrass lesson,
exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, we've got this Torlon pick here, which is, you know, there's been this whole wave of really fancy aerospace plastics used for picks. Yeah, this is one of them, made by my friend Ben in Cambridge.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, so like, sort of how bluegrass came to be was, you know, it's interesting in that you can trace it back to one person, Bill Monroe, who, you know, it's not often you could say this, but I think you can pretty definitively say he invented bluegrass, and it hasn't changed all that much since he did so. Yeah, it got codified really early on, and it's kind of stuck that way. But kind of the way he did it, he truly sort of took the music that he liked, all of his influences, and put it together into a you know, his own thing, which is the attitude that I've kind of carried into making this record and into a lot of my music making in general for most of my career thus far. Taking all the music that I like, and it's not even so conscious, I don't think. It's more just me chasing my ear and chasing the sounds that I want to hear. Yeah, so there's a lot of different bluegrass stuff. There's the really sort of, you know, classic fiddle tunes.
Mm-hmm.
which is sort of the Appalachian string band music that came from Scotland and Ireland, a lot of those tunes. And Bill also took actually quite a bit of influence from rock and roll, kind of early rockabilly kind of stuff. You get tunes like... You get things that sound like that, which, yeah, that's kind of... the bluegrass vocabulary, I guess, you know, there's all this really bluesy stuff along with the beautiful fiddle tunes. And you can kind of, you know, you can generalize it down to that, those two things meeting in a lot of ways. One of the most direct compositional parallels I can draw is sort of this idea of fiddle tune structure, where you sort of, you take Whiskey Before Breakfast, this fiddle tune. It's like you have two phrases, right, that you've heard in this part. Give the first half of the first phrase and the second half of the first phrase. We call those A and B. And then and the second phrase, you get A again, and then you get something different to end with. So you get a C, you know, kind of microsection. And I definitely kind of taken a lot of ideas from that and sort of like how to structure composition, structure tunes.
Oh, cool.
And right, you can go really super deep with that, of course. You can go like into all kinds of micro levels, but kind of in brief, that's the idea that I kind of used to write a lot of tunes.
Oh, that's cool. Thank you for bringing that. Does that mandolin have a name?
Big Red. It's very red. You can't really see it. I mean, Cindy can
Beautiful.
See it, but yeah,
I can see it. It is red.
Indeed. Can confirm.
So you've talked about like tradition not being static, like tradition as a living thing. And when you worked with Daryl on the new album, you have talked about how he's a player who has kind of created his own tradition. And this is your first album of original material. So you're kind of... pioneering your own tradition. So how has your definition of tradition changed since recording Gambit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, Daryl put it really nicely. This record really kind of feels like an overview of a lot of, you know, the tradition that like Daryl was a big part of creating, or David Grisbin, Bela Fleck, people like this who laid the groundwork for a lot of the tunes that I've now written. So yeah, I do think that there's a beautiful tradition of sort of these kinds of tunes. I don't have a great name for it. Some people use new acoustic music, which I don't really love.
That sounds lame.
Yeah. It's a little,
it's hard.
It's hard to put a name on it, but yeah.
Yeah. I relate to this because there is like, I work in radio, and the format that I work in is called AAA, which means Adult Album Alternative. And it's like a, such a mishmash of like what that could possibly mean. And it's like the worst name ever. So, and nobody has like sat down to actually like think of a new good name, you know, because also like who has time for that? Ethan, you're too busy.
Right.
To think of a new name for this. But anyway, sorry, I digress.
Totally. No, I think that's I hear that. That's, I hate trying to put a label on it. So I've kind of tried to refrain as much as possible. And I mean, you end up calling it folk music, which I guess technically it would be folk music, but that doesn't feel super, but anyway, I think that like, it's interesting just being in a continuum of musicians, because like things keep getting refined, you know, people's tune writing gets more and more sophisticated and complex and pure over time. And, you know, as an individual and also as a style, you know, all these beautiful tunes have been written by many different people already. And there's a lot of people out there kind of still building on that and bringing their own thing to the table. So yeah, I think it's really a good time to be making this kind of music, a really invigorating time to be doing it.
That's so rad. Yeah. Okay. In working with Daryl, I found this quote that said, Satyawan found that he was able to make the most musical choices for each tune because of Daryl, leaving academic influences aside. Which sounds like a, I don't know how hard it was for you to like work through being too academic in your music, but what does your threshold and desire to take risks musically look like now?
Yeah, I think some of that kind of goes back to like feeling really comfortable around Daryl, and comfortable in like making choices, making musical choices and decisions. And I think, yeah, I think I probably am a little more willing to kind of go for things than I used to be, on balance, at least. I also think, again, it's about following the music where it wants to go for whatever ensemble it is one happens to be playing with, and trying to always make the best choices for the music of the moment. And if the thesis of the music is to kind of try a lot of crazy things, then that's what we'll do. And if the thesis of the music is to like play a fiddle tune six times in a row, then we'll do that. And sort of just by merit of the people that you choose to play music with, you get very different sort of results at the end of those processes.
Can you imagine what you're going to be like when you're like 65 years old?
I can't, no. Amazing. I can't. It's going to be crazy.
Wow.
I don't know what that's going to be.
I'm really excited for that. Well, I'll be like 100. So
nice.
Let's take our time getting there.
Perfect.
Patreon. So you have a Patreon and I have a question about it. But it's more of like a bigger question than just having a Patreon. So you offer transcriptions on your Patreon and you offered live streams of your practice sessions. Did that, did you actually do that?
I did. Yeah. I kind of eased back on that. That was a deep COVID sort of thing, but yes, I did.
What did you learn from opening your practices up to fans? Like, was it a vulnerable experience for you?
Yeah, it was interesting because I would just do it on Facebook, actually, and people would be there and tune in and they would ask questions, which is kind of interesting to like be practicing and working on stuff. And then you know, you read the comments or whatever and somebody says, how would you play over? Well, somebody asked actually about one of Daryl's tunes. It's called Ride the Wild Turkey, of course.
That old classic.
Exactly. What a chestnut. So somebody asked about Ride the Wild Turkey and how to play over it. It has this kind of weird B part that is a, sort of a normal phrase length.
So wait, that's a fiddle, the fiddle tune, right?
It's
like
a fiddle tune.
How to play mandolin. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How to solo over it, I guess. How to improvise over that fiddle tune was the question. And the B part is kind of funny. You know, it's not irregular. It's a kind of a normal phrase length. But it's set up in a funny way so that it feels really off kilter. People got to see me kind of work through that, and I, you know, when I slow down and really start to work on things, I start to tear stuff apart, and I can, you know, at this point I can fake my way through a lot of things. But if I sit down and work on something, it's not about faking your way through whatever. And of course, faking your way eventually is just knowing how to play things and do. You know, fake it till you make it in the most true of senses.
Such a cornerstone of learning.
Yeah,
of
course.
Fake it till you make it.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it doesn't really mean anything, I don't think. You know, if you fake it and nobody knows that you're faking it, did you really fake it?
Right. So you play sideman to Daryl Anger and also Tony Trischka, among others. You have a couple of bands that we've talked about, including the quartet Corner House. And in Corner House's bio, it reads, "The quartet's unique strength is their desire to learn from one another, not only in musical skill and style, but in life experience, such that every challenge overcome by one band member becomes part of the group's shared musical and personal DNA." That sounds awesome. What does your growth look like thanks to this particular characteristic of Corner House?
Yeah, Corner House is interesting because, like I kind of said a little earlier, Louise and Casey in the band are coming from either the contra dance tradition or the Scottish fiddle tradition and sort of all the offshoots of that, Irish music, Scandinavian music, that sort of thing. And then the guitarist, who is also Ethan Hawkins, and myself, come from a more bluegrass American music background. So that band has always been about, like, how do we play together? How do we make this work? And we've definitely sort of forged our own way to sort of play music together. But a big part of that early on was, how do we play each other's music? You know, how do we kind of understand how we all work? So yeah, that's been a really cool thing about that band, just being able to dig deep into, you know, again, different styles that I wouldn't otherwise play very much of, or yeah, necessarily play very much of, and really stretch ourselves that way. And I think that we take that through to, you know, our other experiences as a band, you know, really working together on touring and being out there and making records and all that stuff. And yeah.
Maine. You live in Cornish, Maine.
Indeed.
Which is a cute little town in the outskirts of Portland in southern Maine. Anna Tivell's sister lives in Maine. Do you know her?
No, I don't.
Well, I think she's like a wedding and event planner.
Oh,
so
cool.
If you need any events planned, her stuff looks great.
Great.
Anywho, what brought you there to Maine versus a music town like Nashville? Why do you remain? Is this your forever home? Do you want to hang out when I move to Maine in January?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, I ended up moving to Maine during the pandemic after moving out of Boston. And the original idea was to move to Portland, Maine, which is a fun city and a nice little music scene over there. You know, the idea was to be right in the city, but that didn't happen for various reasons. And so I ended up out in the country a little bit, still being really connected to the Boston scene and the Portland scene as far as musical communities in the geographical area. And honestly, it's been great. It's been great to be sort of out in the country with a lot of space. I like to fish. I actually just went fishing with somebody I met at the show last night over here in Vermont. So it's been really great to kind of be out in nature some, especially kind of during pandemic times a couple years ago, really deep pandemic times at least. And it, you know, it's actually a really great place to sort of come back to after being on the road. It's really when I'm really busy, like I have been this year, and I'm out every weekend, just about, if I come home for 3 days or 4 days, just being out in this house in the country has been a really amazing thing to come home to, kind of to my surprise. But yeah, it's been great.
Awesome. Do you have time for a lightning round?
Oh yeah, go ahead. Definitely.
Okay, here we go. What is your karaoke song?
Oh man, not for everyone karaoke. Cloudy, Paul Simon, Simon and Garfunkel.
What is your favorite instrument to accompany the mandolin?
It's been really fun playing with cello players, actually, recently.
Where is the best coffee?
I would say that Maddie Whittler makes the best coffee.
Ooh, all right. Okay, this is a controversial question.
Good.
What is your favorite music camp?
Oh, that is a controversial one. Actually, I have an answer. I think it would be the Ospie Valley String Camp. This camp
nice.
That happens in July. Yeah, really fun. Really great.
I've heard so much about Ospie from Carolyn Kendrick.
It's really good.
Has told me about it. Yeah, I'd like to go. Next year, I'm there.
Yeah, do it.
Okay, very important question. Dogs or cats?
Cats.
Whoa. Okay, we are definitely hanging out.
Oh, great. Good.
What's the last book you read?
I just read a book. What is it called? I don't even know what it's called. It's from like 2012. It's like a profile of a bunch of different fancy restaurants in Maine from 2012. I don't know if they're all around still, but at least, you know, 11 years ago, these were the hot restaurants in Maine.
That's so funny. You're like, here's what I'm going to do. An 11-year-old restaurant guide.
You know, it was all the library hats. The Cornish library, so.
I'm going to mail you a book.
Oh, thanks.
What TV show are you currently obsessed with?
Oh, man. I don't really watch a lot of TV, but I've been, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I've been playing the new Legend of Zelda game on Nintendo Switch. That's kind of the closest parallel, I think.
Yeah, I've heard about it. Okay. What is the best road snack?
I've been really into almonds lately.
What is your most useful non-musical skill?
Starting a fire.
Where is your favorite fishing spot?
I love the Aspie River, Brighton Cornish.
How convenient.
Exactly.
Okay, this is the last question. Where is the most beautiful place you've ever been?
Oh, wow. Corner House went to Scotland on tour several years ago, and there was this really cool show basically on, you know, on the ocean, on this little sound of water on the west coast of Scotland, kind of near the Isle of Skye. And so, you know, basically the show was nice and it was in this little cabin, but then just going outside there, there's sort of this sound, and then there's a big mountain, and it's really kind of beautiful and wooded around there. There was an otter. That was pretty good.
Oh, there's an otter?
There's an otter.
Ugh. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Ethan Satiouan, thank you so much for talking to me today. Congratulations on the new record.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me. Yeah, definitely.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by John Nungesser. Our music composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can search on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk, or you can check out our website, basicfolk.com. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. If you enjoyed this episode and you know other mandolin nerds, please send them Ethan's episode. They'll really enjoy it, and they'll play mandolin at your next event, which is what everyone wants. Am I right? Yeah, I'm right. Okay, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.